Rise like lions after slumber in unvanquishable number. Shake your chains to earth like dew, which in sleep had fallen on you. Ye are many, they are few. So wrote Percy Bysshe Shelley of the 1819 Peterloo Massacre in Manchester, England. On that occasion, rioters demanding reforms of parliamentary representation were attacked by a troop of cavalry, resulting in 15 deaths and hundreds of injuries. The memory of Peterloo was just one cause of tension in England in the 1840s. It was a time of poverty and unrest. And yet by the 1880s, England was a confident nation of progress and prosperity. Who were the key players in making such a fast transition? I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. My guest is Simon Heffer, author of various books of English history and biography and a professor of British history at the University of Buckingham. His most recent book is High Minds, The Victorians and the Birth of Modern Britain, published by Pegasus Books in 2022. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you very much, Norman. It's a delight to be here.
And I wish we could make this a mini-series just based on your book. There is so much packed into it so many players and so many situations addressed and some corrected in the course of just four decades. But if we look at England in 1840, what kind of a country do we find?
Well, we find a rather unhappy country. Queen Victoria had become queen 3 years earlier. It wasn't unhappy because of her. It was unhappy because there was growing poverty. There'd been a big slump in America, in your country, in the 1830s, and America had been a tremendous market for Britain, particularly for British finished goods, like cotton goods from our cotton mills in Lancashire, and woolen goods from our woolen mills in Yorkshire. And when Americans in particular stopped buying those goods in such large quantities, it had a terrible effect on employment and on the standard of living in those areas. And of course, the less that was being manufactured in our factories, it also meant that we were building fewer and fewer ships to export these things around the world, and the factories themselves required less and less coal to power them. And of course, in 1840, Britain was a nation powered by coal. So a lot of miners lost their jobs as well, and there was extensive civil unrest in many of our industrial areas. And it was fed by two other political causes. The first was the Chartist movement. They drew up something in 1838 called the People's Charter, which demanded, among other things, universal suffrage and annual parliaments. And at that stage, there'd been a Reform Act in Britain in 1832. But it had given the vote to a very small number of men, and men only. And a lot of middle-class people didn't have the vote. The working class didn't have the vote. And no women had the vote, despite the fact that the head of state of the country at the time was a woman. And so these injustices were being contested by the Chartist movement. The other great movement that started also in 1838, in the year of Queen Victoria's coronation, was the Anti-Corn Law League. Well, the Corn Laws had been introduced after the Napoleonic Wars by Lord Liverpool's government in 1815 to protect the price of home-produced corn. And that meant to protect the revenues of great landowners in this country, most of whom were supporters of the Tory party and supporters of Lord Liverpool. This meant that if any cereal crops or foodstuffs were imported into the United Kingdom, they had a tariff applied to them, which made them uncompetitive compared with the rather overpriced cereal crops that were being grown by Tory landowners. And one of the functions of this was, by the late 1830s, a lot of people in England couldn't afford to feed themselves properly, and things were especially dire as the 1840s went on in Ireland. As you know, America has benefited from having a vast immigration in the 1840s of people from Ireland. And this was as a result of the potato famine. And in order to prevent more people dying of starvation in Ireland, the British government eventually had to repeal the Corn Laws so that the price of cereal crops fell in the whole United Kingdom, including Ireland, but especially so people in Ireland could afford to buy cereals to make bread, and so they didn't starve. So this is a time of great unrest in the United Kingdom and great unhappiness, and its fundamental causes are economic.
Where did the impetus for reform in, say, the Corn Law or the Chartist movement, where did they actually come from? Who are the individuals who were leading the charge?
Well, the charge for the Chartists was led largely by radicals in what was becoming known as the Liberal Party. But the Chartist movement failed. It peaked in the early 1840s, and its last great attempt to, if you like, overthrow the established power in England was in 1848, at the same time when Europe was beset by revolutions. And it didn't happen here because the Corn Laws were repealed in 1846. And although the voting system hadn't been reformed, a great deal had happened in Britain in the 2 years between the repeal of the Corn Laws and the attempt by the Chartists in April 1848 to jump on the bandwagon of European revolution, in that living conditions and purchasing power for the working classes in the United Kingdom had increased dramatically. So even in those 2 years, people were putting more food on their tables, their real wages had risen, and they were often being put in improved housing. So we didn't have a revolution here. The Corn Law League was a slightly different matter, and it again was led by the Liberal Party, and there are two very famous Liberal statesmen in this country, notably John Bright, but also Richard Cobden, and both of them became members of Parliament. They both had a background as owners of capital. They owned, Cobden owned farms, and Bright owned a mill in Manchester. And they wanted to improve the lot of the people who worked for them. And they were successful. The Anti-Corn Law League was successful. But the man who really drove the repeal of the Corn Laws was a Conservative, or two Conservatives. The Conservative who got it through Parliament was Robert Peel. But the Conservative minister in his administration in 1844, who said, if we don't repeal the Corn Laws, the Irish will starve, was William Gladstone, who, of course, later joined the Liberal Party because of his belief in free trade. You see, the great knock-on effect of taking tariffs off imported foodstuffs was that every other business in the country realised that tariffs were a bad thing, because not only did they overprice quite useful goods that were coming into the country, they also subsidised poor productivity and lack of innovation among British manufacturers, and they closed markets around the world to those countries who were then exercising retaliatory tariffs. Once those retaliatory tariffs came off, and once British manufacturers really had to compete on quality, this country from 1846 to 1873 enjoyed 27 years of consecutive, quite serious growth. And it only ended with the Great Agricultural Depression of the 1870s. So that was achieved by Gladstone, Peel, Cobden and Bright, who all went down as four of Britain's most famous and accomplished statesmen of the whole century.
As far as William Gladstone is concerned, was he involved at all in the improvement of working conditions?
No, that was really the role of, or the initiative of Lord Shaftesbury, who was a Conservative. He was a Tory paternalist. And he was quite horrified by what he saw of the living conditions of the poorest people in England. And from the 1830s onwards, he campaigned for a series of factories acts that not only improved working conditions, but regulated much more strongly who could work. I mean, we had, until I think 1846, we had half-naked women down coal mines pulling trucks full of coal, and children as young as seven. And that was changed by an act that saw that Shaftesbury brought in. Children who worked in factories were eventually only allowed to work there if they were having some part-time education to ensure that they could all read and write. The working day was cut eventually from 12 hours to 8 hours. It took a long time to do it. But again, that was one of Shaftesbury's initiatives. And he didn't die till 1886, and he died heaped with honours because it was recognised by that stage that the working man and woman in Britain owed an enormous amount to him and his foresight and his compassion.
How much of an effect did somebody like Charles Dickens have when it came to labour reform?
Dickens had an enormous impact in alerting his predominantly middle-class readership to just how awful life was for people in the working class. I won't say that he was necessarily a pioneer of labour reform, but so many of his novels, one thinks of Oliver Twist, about life for a boy in a workhouse, or most notably Hard Times, which he published in 1854, and is about the grimness of life in the industrial north. He alerted people whose lives never came anywhere near any point of contact with the poor or the industrial working class to just how awful things were. And I think what he did manage to inspire was a great deal of charitable work. In a country that had a lot of very rich people, none of whom paid very much tax, he was able to persuade them that they should give quite a lot of their money to charitable purposes. And indeed, this period is a great period for the foundation of schools, hospitals, libraries, mainly designed to benefit people who were from the less privileged classes. And he had a huge impact and influence on that.
When you mention education, would somebody like Matthew Arnold also have an impact?
Well, both Matthew Arnold and his father, Thomas Arnold, had an impact. The first chapter of my book is about Dr. Arnold of Rugby. He's thought of as being a great Victorian, but in fact he died in 1842 after only five of Victoria's 64 years on the throne. But he reformed Rugby School, which was a little bit like a cross between a zoo and a daycare centre. In the early 1830s, when he was taking over, he ran it along Christian lines and with very severe discipline. But he tried to bring up the boys who went there to be honest and decent and to turn out gentlemen. And he more or less succeeded, not just at rugby, but so many of the people who were either schoolboys under him at rugby or masters under him at rugby went off to run their own schools. And right up until the 1880s, 1890s, you've got Arnoldian principles being enforced and applied in most of the English public schools and a lot of the English grammar schools, which were the more selective schools run by private charities in little towns in England. And his son, Matthew, who was a very famous writer and literary critic, and whose most famous book, Culture and Anarchy, which was published at the time of the 1867 Reform Act, outlined how what benefits there were of educating otherwise uneducated people. He learned all that from his father, and he became a massive social influence himself. So Arnold's legacy literally lived on for the rest of the 19th century.
Well, I know that you, in a sense, got interested in writing this current book because of your work on writing a biography of Thomas Carlyle. And how did he play into this in terms of a social reformer or a prompter of social reform?
Well, Carlyle was a figure of great fascination to me. Although I'm a historian, my first degree is in English. And when I was studying English at Cambridge University over 40 years ago, Carlyle was an almost unmentioned and unmentionable figure. He was not a believer in democracy. He was as politically incorrect as it's possible to be. He had very, very unsavory views on black people and indeed on Roman Catholics, who were the target of probably his greatest bigotry at the time. But he was a man who had the strongest influence on writers such as Arnold and Dickens, not because they agreed with any of his sort of crackpot ideas about black people or Roman Catholics, but because they looked at Carlyle's thought about the great social questions of the time. I mean, Carlyle used to rail against people who had charitable meetings in London about looking after the plight of emancipated slaves in the colonies. And he would say, well, okay, these are very unfortunate people, but have any of these people ever been to Liverpool or Manchester and seen the horrific, and he wasn't exaggerating, the horrific, insanitary state in which people lived up there, and the almost slave-like labour that some of them had to put in. I mean, being made to work 12 hours a day and for very little money and to live in the most squalid conditions. And Carlyle's argument was, look, before we go around telling the rest of the world how to behave, we should probably sort out the mess on our own doorstep. And that had a tremendous influence. It's why Carlyle wrote Hard Times. He dedicated the book to Carlyle. Arnold was heavily influenced by him when he wrote Culture and Anarchy. So too, of course, was John Ruskin, the leading art historian and cultural critic of the, right. of the period.
As long as you've mentioned race as an issue, slavery was outlawed in the British Empire when 1834. How did that come about?
Well, that's outside the scope of this book. But, I mean, that had begun in the late 18th century through William Wilberforce. I mean, yes, slave trading in the British Empire was banned in 1834, but it was banned in Britain. In 1807, I mean, from 1807, nobody could traffic in slaves and nobody could have shares in a company that did traffic in slaves. It was done because the slaves had never been kept in this country. You occasionally see references in the 17th and 18th century in diaries and journals to fashionable ladies who have a black page boy, and they may have, he may have been living on almost enslaved terms with them. He wouldn't be a salaried member of staff, but he wasn't treated in the viciously brutal way that slaves were treated in the British colonies or indeed in America. He was more like a figure of curiosity when he was seen in Britain. But because Britain had no direct experience of enslaving people in these islands, very early on, had a wave of mass revulsion, but it was still being done abroad and that Britain was still involved with it. And as the British Empire grew, and of course, once we lost the American colonies, we started to, and we had colonies already in the West Indies, and we were acquiring bits of Africa where there were lots of black people who were potential slaves. A lot of people in Parliament here said, well, hang on, we're not going down that road. And of course, Britain was a deeply Christian country. I'm not saying America at the time wasn't, but I mean, there were a lot of churchmen here who said that slavery was an anti-Christian act. As in, I'm not religious, but I think that's probably right. I think that I don't remember Jesus Christ ever saying slavery was a good idea. and so there was a very strong lobby here by the 1780s to get rid of slavery. And the only thing that slowed it down, the only reason it didn't happen until 1807, was the money had to be found to buy people out of the slave trade. Because, again, so many of the people who had a stake in the slave trade were Tory politicians or families of Tory politicians. Gladstone's family were slavers. And in order to get it through Parliament, they had to be compensated. And that had happened by 1807. But, you know, it's one of the few things I think that my country can be really proud of in the 19th century, that we did get out of this disgusting trade very early on.
How did William Gladstone feel about slavery then?
he made a speech as a young man in the House of Commons when he was about 23 or 24, in which he spoke up for his family's interests and said he didn't think his family had done anything that wrong in having slaves. He abundantly recanted later on when he grew up, as he came to understand religion more. He was always a very religious man and always a great theologian, but the more profound his theology came, the more he recognised it was completely incompatible with any sort of support for the slave trade. And he became a very, very firm opponent of it. And of course, in the American Civil War, he didn't want to get involved. He was Chancellor of the Exchequer at the time in Palmerston's government. But he was very much on the side of the North and not the South. He felt the South had an ideology, and in particular where slavery was concerned, that it simply was anachronistic and was no longer tolerable or defensible in the second half of the 19th century.
We're going to look further at High Minds, the Victorians, and the Birth of Modern Britain when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. The two men exemplify the Victorian political mind at its best and worst. Gladstone, the man of principle, even if he had to engage in occasional contortions to try to remain principled, and Disraeli, the opportunist, craving power for its own sake and not because of any great strategy to transform Britain. And as we shall see, at the time of the Second Reform Act of 1867, willing to throw away any principle in order to stay in office. Although there were many shades and gradations of the political mind in the mid-19th century, these two men represented the poles. So says my guest, Simon Heffer, in his new book, High Minds, the Victorians, and the Birth of Modern Britain. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. That is a sharp contrast that you have drawn there, and having to do with the high-minded Gladstone and the power-hungry Disraeli. Would you like to riff on that for a while?
Well, I went into this book with a reasonably open mind. I'd done a lot of work on the Victorians 30 years ago for the book I wrote on Carlyle. And Carlyle hadn't much liked Disraeli. And he had thought there was something to be said, but not very much, for Gladstone. He thought the political class were pretty horrible. I often wonder what he'd make of politicians today, but that's another matter. I went into the book with an open mind, thinking that Disraeli was a bit of a chancer, and Gladstone was a bit priggish. But all my researches, all my studies led to me absolutely loathing Disraeli and really admiring Gladstone. Yeah, because Disraeli was so dishonest. We have a prime minister in our country at the moment who is now routinely described as a liar by newspapers and broadcasters without any danger of them being sued for defamation. So lying is not something people in Britain are unused to when it comes to their political masters. But I was horrified by the specific lie that Disraeli told in the debate on the Corn Laws in 1846, when Peel, in the teeth of opposition from his own party and only with help from the Whigs or the Liberals sitting opposite him, got the Corn Laws repealed. Disraeli was in Parliament. He had no money. He'd recently found a quite rich older woman to marry. And that was very much a marriage of financial convenience.
She said that too, didn't she? Married me for my money.
Yeah, no, I mean, she was under no illusions. He had no shame. He felt, oh, that's all right. Why not? If she's mad enough to marry me, off we go. but he needed more money than even she could supply. And he became a client, as it were, of the Dukes of Portland, the Cavendish-Bentinck family, who were very, very grand people indeed, and who owned a large stretch of the English East Midlands. But they had a very strong belief in not repealing the Corn Laws, because they were precisely the sort of landowners that the Corn Laws benefited. And so Disraeli got up in Parliament. He declared his interest. Everybody knew that he was a spokesman for the Cavendish-Bentinck family. But he made a series of economically illiterate arguments throughout the Corn Law debates on why the Corn Law should stay in place. There was only one argument why the Corn Law should stay in place, and that was to keep rich Tory landowners rich. There was no other argument. And, of course, he couldn't advance it quite in that way, so he tried to find other reasons for doing it. When Peel was making a truly great speech in January 1846 about why the Corn Laws had to be repealed, not least, as I said earlier, to stop large quantities of Irish people starving to death, Disraeli got up and heckled him. And Peel, who was a notably long-tempered man, finally lost his temper and turned round to Disraeli and said, look, I'd take it more easily from you, criticising the government that I lead, if you hadn't kept begging me for some sort of office in it. And Disraeli said, I've never done anything of the sort. Now, we know that in his pocket, Peel had a letter from Disraeli written about 4 years earlier, in which he asked for a job at the administration, but worse than that, asked whether there was some public office that could be given to his brother, to give his brother a decent income.
Well, nepotism thrown in.
Yeah. And Peel saw no reason to help Disraeli, who even then was, was then a non-entity, but already a troublemaker. And so he didn't do it. Now, Peel could have ended Disraeli's political career there and then. Because in those days, if you got up and told a lie to the House of Commons, such as, I never did such a thing as that, I never asked you for a job, Peel had taken the letter out of his pocket and read it out into the parliamentary record, Disraeli would have had to resign from the House of Commons. He would never have been seen again in British politics. He'd have gone off to resume his career as a pretty second-rate novelist.
He was a novelist too, yes.
He was a novelist, and not a particularly good one. He wasn't in sort of Dickens' league or George Eliot's league. So Peel was too much of a gentleman to embarrass Disraeli by reading it out. But and I've talked to people who are Disraeli apologists, and they all admit that this is a very difficult thing for them to explain. Because you can't. It was a barefaced lie. But it was a barefaced lie that Disraeli told to try and save his own skin, as politicians do. And he went a few years later when British politics began a long realignment after the Corn Laws, with some Conservatives leaving the Tory party and joining the Liberals, and vice versa. And there was a coalition government run by Lord Aberdeen in the 1850s that had both Liberals and Conservatives in it. And it was sort of in favour of free trade, but not entirely. And this government could only survive if Gladstone was in it, because Gladstone had such a big constituency in the Liberal Party, and they needed more Liberal support, and they'd only get it by getting someone of Gladstone's temperament and reputation in it. And Disraeli famously went to see Gladstone and begged him to join, and more or less said to him, look, you know, we're all in politics. None of us have really got any principles. We just like being in power. And I like being in power, and you like being in power, so why don't we all get in power together? And you're stopping me being in power because you're being all high and mighty about your principles. And Gladstone just didn't compute. I mean, he just couldn't understand a man as venal as this. And he said, look, just go away. I don't want to talk to you. And Disraeli did go away, and they were never friends again. Not they'd really ever been friends before, but you know, this is 1853-54. Until Disraeli dies in 1881, the two of them never have cordial relations. And for that last 14 years of Disraeli's life, one or the other of them is prime minister. And it's a remarkable time for Britain, but it's a time when Disraeli's own lack of principle becomes clearer and clearer by the day. He becomes prime minister on the back of the 1867 Reform Act.
I was going to ask about that, to extend the vote.
Yeah, to extend the vote. And it had been 35 years in coming. The last one had been 1832. And this was to give the vote to urban working men. There's quite a big constituency of men. And there had been Gladstone, who was not Prime Minister, but was the leader of the House of Commons. The Prime Minister was Lord Russell, who sat in the House of Lords. Gladstone had tried in 1865-66 to get a reform measure through, And the Conservatives, led in the House of Commons by Disraeli, had fought tooth and nail against this, saying it would destroy the country. Gladstone loses. The Liberal government of Russell resigns. And at that point, a series of quite serious riots break out, notably in London, but also in the English provinces, as people demand a measure of electoral reform. You've got working men now who are not through the state, but through their own working men's institutes and their trade unions, have been educated. They've been taught to read. They've been taught to write. They've been distributed pamphlets telling them what their rights ought to be and you know, what the real state of their rights is. And these are people who are becoming increasingly politically engaged and sophisticated because they've got the education to be so. And, you know, the question is dealt with in contemporary novels, notably George Eliot's Felix Holt, The Radical. And there's this overwhelming pressure building up in England in 1866-67 for a measure of reform. And Disraeli, to save his own skin, goes infinitely further in the end than the Liberals were prepared to go and passes a Reform Act that the Liberals broadly support because it's what they'd wanted. But it's something that he had said would happen over his dead body about a year earlier. He is a complete opportunist. He is a man entirely without principle. And for the last 150 or so years, his heirs and successors in the British Conservative Party had sought to justify him by saying, oh, what you don't understand, he was a great pragmatist and the country would have had a revolution but for him. Well, the country would have had a revolution if he'd been sufficiently pragmatic in opposition not to vote down the measure that Gladstone had tried to bring in 1866. So, I mean, the man's a shocking hypocrite. And you add to that the endless sucking up to Queen Victoria. You know, this is the man who famously said to Matthew Arnold, you know, when you flatter royalty, lay it on with a trowel. And he spent, you know, Queen Victoria was not a very clever woman. She's got a reputation far in excess of what she deserved. I speak as a devoted monarchist. She was petulant. She was irrational. She was poorly educated and had a completely untrained mind. And she responded very well to people like Disraeli, just ingratiating themselves with her and sucking up to her and telling her that she was wonderful. And the whole thing was completely pitiful. And then when he goes out in 1860, he loses an election because all the working men who'd been recently enfranchised show their disdain for him by voting for the Liberals under Gladstone. Gladstone then introduces a really reforming ministry that introduces things such as competition for senior jobs in the civil service. We stop selling commissions in the army and people have to earn them. And we introduce a place at elementary school for every child under the age of 12 in this country, the first time he had any commitment to universal education. So, again, it's another measure that I use to gauge the success of Gladstone and his genuine belief in improving the lot of the British people against Disraeli, who just liked being in power. And if people got a better deal as a result of it, it was usually by accident.
We'll look further at this remarkable transition in England from the 1840s to the 1880s when we return in a moment. This is University of the Year. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Simon Heffer. He's the author of the new book, High Minds, The Victorians and the Birth of Modern Britain, the saga of how England changed radically for the better in the course of really just four short decades of all kinds of progress. We have touched on, but we haven't really delved into educational changes in Britain. There is increased literacy, though, I think you've already said, better education for starters. But how does that proceed in those 40 years?
Well, at the time when my book starts, there is no compulsory education for anyone in Britain. Of course, the well-to-do in the middle classes have always educated their sons, in some enlightened cases, their daughters, because they viewed their sons as having the job of running the country as in the next generation, certainly running their estates if they've got big estates. And so they needed to know about the ways of the world, and they'd also their sons would have the vote if they were from that well-to-do class, and they needed to have something instilled in their minds in order to exercise that vote responsibly. But there is a growing demand for education, and the trade union movement and various charities right throughout the 1830s, 40s, 50s are setting up working men's institutes where the working class, not just men, but also some women, can go and have lessons. One of the great progenitors of that movement was Thomas Arnold, who used to go to a mechanics institute in Rugby, in the town of Rugby, when he was headmaster of Rugby in the 30s and early 40s, and teach basic history and literature to the people who were the working men of the town who went there. So there was always a thirst for education, and it's something that England had always lagged behind Scotland in doing. Everybody thinks of Scotland as being a rather backward
somehow, yes.
Compared with England. It's not true. They had an enlightenment in Scotland in the 18th century, and they also very strongly believed in educating people. Thomas Carlyle, who was a peasant from Dumfriesshire, went at the age of, I think, 13 or 14, to Edinburgh University. He had so little money, he used to walk the 73 miles from Dumfriesshire to Edinburgh to the university at the beginning of every term and walk back again at the end of the term. So he was an example of how educational opportunity went much further down the social system in Scotland than it did here. But in England, you didn't get an education unless you were middle class or upper middle class. The upper middle classes went to public schools. There were 9 schools called the Clarendon Schools. They include the ones that everybody around the world has heard of, such as Eton and Harrow and Westminster and Winchester. But there were a lot of minor public schools that were founded in the 19th century because of the expansion of the middle class. There were more and more people who could afford to send their children to private schools. And these schools grew up in response to that demand. There were also, in a lot of English towns, what were known as grammar schools. And these had often been founded in the 15th or 16th or 17th centuries by local people who wanted to get the money together to provide an educated class for their own town. One of the great founders of grammar schools was King Edward VI, who died at the age of 16. He ruled from the age of 10 and 16, and he managed to found about 30 grammar schools in the few years he was on the throne. I went to one of them, so I'm very much in favour of him. But a lot of towns didn't have these ancient schools, and by the middle of the 19th century, it was becoming obvious to everybody, not just that there wasn't the educated population that could benefit from having the vote, that is, that would exercise the vote in a responsible way, having read lots of election literature and worked out who was going to do what for them, but also that the human capital of the country was underexploited, that there were so many millions of people in Great Britain in the 19th century who were capable of doing so much more with their lives than just standing on a production line in a factory. Or doing the most menial work in domestic service. And some people in the upper classes feared this. They feared that the class system would break down, and they feared that they with their ancient privileges would be overthrown by a suddenly newly educated proletariat who would throw them out. That never, of course, happened. But we did get to a stage by the end of the 19th century, where there was more social mobility in this country than there probably ever been. And that was because the Gladstone government of 1868 to 1874 started to facilitate the provision of school places for every child, every boy or girl, between the ages of 5 and 12.
Did you say this was compulsory?
No, it wasn't compulsory, and many people didn't take it up. And you had to pay. You had to pay a small amount of money, usually tuppence per child per week. It was a very small amount of money. But what the government promised to do was if you had a child, wherever you lived, you may have to walk to the next village or something, but that child would have a place. And the people who didn't take this up tended to be in the agricultural districts, because they said, well, look, we need our children to help get harvested and to help do other jobs. You know, we can't have them at school. Whereas if they lived in industrial areas, as I said earlier, one of the conditions from the 1840s of working in a factory was you had to go to school. You could work in the afternoons in the factory, but you had to go to school 4 or 5 mornings a week. So the industrial proletariat in Britain had begun to be taught, if you like, from the 1840s. And if you go around England, there are quite a lot of Church of England schools, because the Church of England took a big role in this, that have foundation stones dating from the 1840s and 1850s that were founded to provide places of education up to the age of 12 for children. But it wasn't really until the 20th century, after the First World War, after 1918, that there were places for children up to the age of 14 or above who didn't come from the moneyed classes. But compulsory education came in 1902, and there was an element of compulsion brought in 1876 that already existed for children in rural areas, in urban areas, and it was introduced for children in rural areas. So you did get to the stage by the middle of the 1870s that virtually every child between the ages of 5 and 12 should have an education. You then got to the problems, well, not the problem, you then got to the question of what do we do about women, because there had been nowhere to educate women properly in Britain until about the 1850s. There was a university college funded for women in the 1840s. Cheltenham Ladies College, very famous girls' private school in England, came along in the 1850s, and there was a rash of schools after that to teach girls. But it wasn't until 1869 that the first women's college was founded at Cambridge. And although it was founded as part of Cambridge University, it actually started off in North London because it was felt to be unsafe to let all these young women too close to so many young men in the University of Cambridge. And indeed, when it did, this is Girton College, when it did in 1869, I think, eventually move to Cambridge, it was set on the outskirts of Cambridge in order to try and deter young men from going up there and having their evil way with the young women who were learning.
It was not coeducational. In other words, there was still a good deal of segregation, separation between the sexes. Oh, yeah.
And although the University of Cambridge very early on allowed women to take its exams, it didn't allow them until 1948 actually to proceed to degrees. So they could say, well, I passed an exam. I technically got a first-class degree at Cambridge in such and such a subject, but I wasn't allowed to graduate because they didn't believe in doing it. Oxford, which also got two university colleges, I think St. Hugh's and St. Hilda's or Lady Margaret Hall, in the 1870s, just after Cambridge got Girton and Newnham, did allow the award of degrees in 1920. So Oxford was ahead of Cambridge in that regard. As a Cambridge man, I'm always reluctant to admit that. But they did start to allow women to have degrees. So two of the great things that happened in the period that this book covers, between the 1840s and the 1880s, were we decided as a nation it was a good thing to try and educate the working class, and we decided as a nation it was a good thing to start to educate women.
And doesn't that then suggest that an educated woman should be capable of voting wisely?
Well, of course. And once you start to educate women properly, it becomes absurd that women with degrees from Oxford and Cambridge aren't allowed to vote, whereas the man who they employ to make their fires up for them or to drive their cars for them or to drive their horses and carriages for them can vote. It's absurd. And, I mean, the arguments against women's suffrage become more and more stupid as they go on. And you know, they start the great start of this is 1869. It's the same year that Girton College, Cambridge is founded. And this is when Jacob Bright, who's the brother of John Bright, whom I mentioned earlier, the great Corn Law reformer, tries to get a women's suffrage bill through Parliament, and he fails. There are a few radicals who support it, but it fails. And the same year, John Stuart Mill brings out his book on the subjection of women, which talks about the idiocy of not allowing women to have the vote. And it's obviously an unanswerable argument, but people try to answer it. And what's so strange about late Victorian England, to say has a head of state who is a woman, is that it's not a question that divides on party lines. While most liberals are in favour of women having the vote, some of them aren't. Notably, after my book is finished, it's in the next one, but notably Herbert Asquith, who becomes Prime Minister in 1908, and is a distinguished figure in the Liberal Party from the 1880s. He won't have any truck with women's voting at all until he is Prime Minister during the Great War, and he sees that without the efforts of women on the land, in munitions factories, and doing white-collar jobs that have freed up men to go to the front to fight, Britain would probably have lost the Great War. So he's an eventual convert. And there are one or two Conservatives who are rather unfashionably in favour of women having the vote. But most Conservatives say, well, it's over my dead body. You know, we can do perfectly well without having women tell us how to vote. But once you start educating women, the same forces apply as when you start educating working class men. They are sufficiently intellectually equipped to know how to cast a vote, and therefore they should be allowed to do so.
Well, as you point out, I mean, it is ironic that Queen Victoria herself could not have voted.
No. We also had a law in this country until 1882, and it was medieval common law. It had been how things had been since before the Norman Conquest, in fact, where the minute a woman got married, any property she had became her husband's, and her husband could do what he liked with it. So if you were an heiress, if you were a man who married an heiress and you suddenly acquired millions of pounds, which in Victorian times was a fortune beyond imagination, you could, if you wanted to, spend it all as you saw fit. If you wanted to spend it on, you know, cocaine and hookers or whatever the equivalent was in those days, you could do so and your wife couldn't lift a finger. And
gambling.
Gambling, absolutely. But usually it seems, you know, sex workers. That would be the thing that most men would seem to want to spend it on, or mistresses. Anyway, in the end, in 1882, Gladstone's second ministry said, look, enough is enough. We're not going down that road any longer. And they repealed it, the Married Women's Property Act. It meant that a woman at last had control of her own assets and didn't have to hand them over to her husband and say to him, right, you can now do what you like with these.
There were some prominent role models, female role models in the 19th century who might have helped to at least inspire the idea that women were capable of voting. I'm thinking of Florence Nightingale, for example.
Yes. Florence Nightingale was obviously a formidable figure and most famous, of course, for saving the lives of countless British soldiers in the Crimean War in 1854-55. Simply by introducing proper standards of nursing, by disinfecting and preventing the spread of infection. And she lived to be 90 and did various good works in the rest of her life in campaigning for a higher standard of nursing in British hospitals. And it was not least down to her that the number of women who died in childbirth and the incidence of death of children under the age of five dramatically reduced in Britain over the next 50 years, not least because of reforms. And she, you know, she standardised and regulated the profession of nursing and stopped it from just being something that any untrained woman could do to something that you required some sort of knowledge of biology and chemistry to do and to do it properly. She was, however, a great hysteric. She decided when she was 40 in 1860 that she was going to die. And she went to bed for 50 years. She didn't get out of bed until she died in 1910.
Well, what did she do in there? Did she write?
She wrote. She hectored people. She wrote letters of abuse to politicians. She was very good at getting people to do things for her. Her cousin by marriage was the poet Arthur Hugh Clough, and she effectively killed him through overwork. He had a full-time job, and then in the evenings she would summon him and say, right, Arthur, I want you to do the following jobs for me. And, he's Lytton Strachey in his book Eminent Victorians mocks Clough for tying up brown paper parcels for Florence Nightingale. But that's what he was doing. He acted as her sort of secretary and clerical assistant and died of overwork. She was a tremendous example of what a woman could do if she put her mind to it. But there were others. I mean, there was Mrs. Fawcett, who was the wife of a Liberal cabinet minister, who from the late 1860s, probably one of the cleverest people, never mind women, in Britain, was an early fighter for women's suffrage and would go around looking for fights with men she considered to be ignorant and stupid because they didn't agree with her, which was usually true, actually. They usually were ignorant and stupid for that reason. And she would take them apart in review articles, and she was brilliant at doing that. I write in the book about one of the great conservative tracts of the 1870s, a book by a lawyer called Sir James Fitzjames Stephen called Liberty, Equality, Fraternity, which is a fantastic read. He was notionally a liberal, but he was one of the most illiberal people in Britain. And she reviewed the book and simply took him to pieces for his suppositions about all sorts of things that she and he disagreed on. But it's a measure of her considerable brain. And a statue of her now stands in Parliament Square in London in recognition of just how important she was in getting women the vote. She became a suffragist rather than a suffragette. The suffragettes were committed to a campaign of violent terrorism to get the vote. She never believed in breaking the law, but she just used argument and reason to get the vote. And she is an immensely highly regarded woman in Britain today, even now, more than 100 years after her death.
One of the high minds that helped England to make the transition from those grim 1840s into the enlightened and prosperous 1880s and years beyond, Simon Heffer, it's been a great pleasure.
Well, it's been a great pleasure for me too, and thank you for asking me.
He's the author of High Minds, The Victorians, and The Birth of Modern Britain, published in 2022 by Pegasus Books. I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you can join me next time for University of the Air.